Welcome to The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. I'm your host, Jason, and today we have some veterans back. Dr. Mark Roger Graves and the Reverend Dr. Dixon Kinzer.
Boom.
Doctor.
Doctor.
Hi, gentlemen. Mark, this is your first time back since recording way back in November, I checked.
That's right, yes.
How are you feeling? Are you rusty at all?
Rusty and confident.
Good. I like that.
Yeah. I have been in the off season, you know, working out.
Okay,
as it were. So.
The Rocky soundtrack on
exactly.
in the background.
Exactly. Yeah. But like the 1970s Rocky soundtrack.
Sure.
None of this Pantera stuff.
Well, so 1970s Rocky training, like punching slabs of meat or like...
Yes, yes, with the brass band and the orchestra in the background.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Not chopping wood.
No. Okay. No.
Apollo Creed, not...
No, no Apollo
Creed. Not Drago.
No.
No. Creed is your opponent.
Creed is my opponent.
So I'm Creed.
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. I'm the champion.
Anyways.
Yeah, take you down.
Dixon, you've actually been doing quite a few episodes lately. How are you feeling?
I'm excited about this.
Good.
So Mark and I, when you assigned these matchup topics, Mark and I both found each other and we're like, okay, most, and it was titled Revolutionary Anglican.
Right.
And so we sort of like found each other and we're like, all right, we're going to be paired up. This is exciting. And we were both like, there's somebody I'm thinking of that we're not going to do. And I was like, who are you thinking of? And he's like, who are you thinking of? And then we both agreed we would not share that fact.
Yeah.
And so we've waited months for this podcast because both to spring our actual picks on one another, but also to disclose who's the person we think we're not going to do.
I think it is thoroughly possible that you both chose what you thought you weren't supposed to be doing. If that makes any sense.
No.
Wait. Okay.
All right. You ready? I'm just going to drop it.
Well, hold on.
No.
So here's the thing. So dear listener, Jason, who is moving around a lot.
Stop. For the record, my husband was criticizing me for moving around too much and he's disturbing my flow. And now Dixon won't let it go.
So Jason gave us the topic of most revolutionary Anglican, which has a certain connotation to it. And so our minds started thinking that direction. And then when we later came back to him and said, hey, what do you mean by revolutionary? He's like, well, really what I mean is most influential. Yeah. Anglican, across Anglicanism's history.
Across the world is what all Christianity. Yes.
So that's sort of our take on this thing. And so we have made picks based on that criteria.
Yeah.
However, the revolutionary one was when we first started this, little person we're not going to pick thing. So,
okay.
I'm ready to share either or both or neither.
All right.
I'm ready to share who I did not pick, we agreed not to pick.
Okay.
Wait till after the first story and then we'll see.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Well, we'll see. Just wait. So as Dixon mentioned, it's the most revolutionary Anglican. And I think you got it right about sort of how we quantified it. You think that was right?
Yeah.
Sort of like made the biggest impact in the world or most significant. In each episode, our two guests will present their cases. We'll talk a little about it. And after the episode, you listeners get to vote on who told the most compelling story. I'm the only person who knows what story each person is going to tell until now. Dixon, would you like to go first today?
You know I would love to go first.
Okay.
Okay, so picking an influential Anglican.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to try to think about breadth of impact across generations and something that wasn't necessarily political. Like once we moved off the revolutionary thing, I was like, well, like what does influence mean and how is one influential? Because there was some low hanging fruit out there that, I can't talk about right now because we haven't shared what the low hanging fruit was. So for my pick for most influential Anglican, Clive Staples Lewis.
Oh, interesting.
All right. So
I'm not going to roll my eyes at that.
Oh, look at that. No eye rolls.
I applaud you. Good. For a solid choice. That's still not the most influential one, but second most influential.
Yeah. If you don't know, Mark has a C.S. Lewis tattoo on his back and basically is living that life with the way he dresses and his interests. Okay. So C.S. Lewis, more commonly known, Clive Staples, is... he was a professor of English literature at Oxford and then later Cambridge. His favorite genres, though, were North mythology and science fiction, which I'll get to. You probably know him because you have heard of the Narnia series, yeah. Which includes The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He also is famous for his works of very popular theology. So works like Mere Christianity, The Great Divorce, I'll kind of get to some of those at the end. But just to tell his story really quickly, as much as he is known as like this English, quintessential Englishman, and particularly kind of popular theologian and scholar, he is Irish. Lewis is born in Belfast before the sectarian divides, which is sort of influential to him. He at age four, he loses his dog in a car accident. I think the dog got hit by a car. The dog was not driving or an accident. I should phrase that better. Dog's name is Jaxie, and he is so distraught by this, he would answer to no other name but the dog's name, Jaxie. Oh. Then basically that became a nickname that he was known by among friends and family for the rest of his life. So Jack was his nickname, and you'll see that referenced. Okay. What's interesting to me is that he is this professor of medieval literature, and he goes by the name of his dog. Have we not missed this Last Crusade reference from Indiana Jones for all these years?
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, especially Henry Jones and Indiana.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, interesting.
All right, so...
I'll refrain from doing my Connery impersonation.
I was going to say...
I will resist.
All the more reason I felt like this was a good one to bring in the room with you. His mother dies at age nine. He ends up in England for school. That's how he starts to get connected to England. There's a lot of culture shock for him. Mm-hmm. He finds himself resentful of the English because they talk different than him and have a different culture. And he kind of, I think there's a little chip on the shoulder between the two cultures as close as they are. And he ends up getting over it. But around the age of 15, he kind of starts deconstructing. And he was raised in this religious household, which is part of the Church of England. Church of Ireland's the Irish branch of the Church of England. And he gets really angry with God for either not existing or equally angry for creating a world that is so imperfect and has suffering in it. And he kind of feels very convinced by that in the way that a lot of people feel that, it's like it just doesn't make sense. And this world doesn't make sense. And if God was good and created it, then it would be a lot better than it is. So there is no God. This is the sort of logic. And around this time, he starts to really get interested in the Norse and Scandinavian mythologies that gave birth to his Celtic culture. And that becomes really like impactful on him. And that's when he starts to get into science fiction and epic poetry and the occult. And he's very sort of taken with all that. World War I crops up. He enlists like everybody else does. And like all his contemporaries, he sort of returns with the scars of war and its horrors. And that seems to only cement his atheism. As he goes into university and then later academia, it is through conversations with another colleague in the Oxford Cambridge University system, one J.R.R. Tolkien, who is a Roman Catholic and is very committed to his faith, also has a deep interest in mythology around the English peoples, that he Lewis is ultimately persuaded back into his Christian faith and it sort of returns to what he held as his childhood, but I think is able to hold it in a different way, watching Tolkien, who also bears the scars of war and is someone that's actually intelligent and has all those kind of a way to dialogue around those intense questions that Lewis was bringing to the table. He is famously part of a little literary society with Tolkien called the Inklings. It included a bunch of other writers that aren't as notable as the two of them. When he dies, I'm jumping ahead to the end. When he dies of kidney failure on the same day as JFK's assassination.
Oh, wow.
Which is why a lot of people didn't know that he passed, and it kind of got overshadowed because, you know, the president of the United States is assassinated in this, you know, public and gory kind of way. His first academic works were focused on the use of allegory in the literature of the Middle Ages. But of course, what he becomes known for are all these sort of popular works that he writes. And so he is the author of lots of different things, some of which we've mentioned, a book called Mere Christianity, which began not as a book, but as a series of radio addresses. Mm-hmm. Not radio addresses on Christian radio, just on the radio, like to his people. Let's talk about the logic of the Christian faith, like why Christianity makes sense is Lewis's starting point. Like Christianity has a logical coherence that can be understood. But he's also written books that you've heard of, like The Screwtape Letters, The Great Divorce, The Problem of Pain, Till We Have Faces, which is a retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche. He's a classics guy, right? Yeah. And he like weaves all this into his writings. The Four Loves, which is a meditation on the four different words for love, the New Testament. If some of this even sounds cliche to you, it's because Lewis is like overly quoted and referenced by lots and lots of Christians across the world, but has had particular resonance among evangelicals in the United States, especially as the 20th century sort of wound up and bore to a close, and then we went into the 21st century. I have a theory about that. It's worth mentioning because it was the evangelicals in the middle of the 20th century that developed Christian media. They created that whole sort of apparatus. And so it was writers in that vein that found Lewis's logical approach so appealing, because that was how they approached the faith. But he also has all these works of fiction. I've already mentioned the Chronicles of Narnia, Chronicles of Narnia. If you know, you know. But he's got like the Space Trilogy, which are science fiction works with like Perelandra and Out of the Silent Planet. And what's the other one? I wrote it down. I can't remember it. And he's the subject of several biopics. Biopics about his conversion, biopics about his love affair, like Shadowlands. He's played by Anthony Hopkins in that one. But here's what's interesting. He's, for all of these books, and I don't have time to go through his entire CV, it's too long. But he earned not really one penny for the royalties of his books. He gave away all the royalties.
Wow.
Like he set up a foundation early on, and took a modest salary. And I think he got advances on the books, but then basically had a charitable trust that, gave away, whatever he earned, which I thought was really cool. The Times, English newspaper ranked him 11th on their list of the 50 greatest British writers since 1945. In 2013, on the 50th anniversary of his death, Lewis joined some of Britain's greatest writers in the Poets' Corner of Westminster Abbey. And there was a dedication service, including a reading from The Last Battle by his stepson. Flowers were laid by Walter Hooper, who's a trustee and literary advisor of the Lewis estate. And an address was delivered by former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. The floorstone inscription is a quotation from an address by Lewis that says, "I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." In Christianity Today, which is an evangelical publication, listed Mere Christianity as the best book of the 20th century.
Whoa.
For reasons that I think I mentioned earlier. Now, here's why this guy, I would argue, is most influential. All right.
Okay, I'm ready for it.
Number one, he's a man of his time. So like Lewis's writings and his arguments and his approach are very, very much of the kind of early to middle 20th century, again, with this sort of appeal to Christianity's reasonableness. That's a very kind of Enlightenment vibe. And in some ways, it's quintessentially Anglican, because that was a little bit of the energy that our great theologians wrote our Books of Common Prayer and our own theologies. You know, Hooker is writing from natural reason and natural order. Cranmer's approaching it this way. However, you will find a lot of people today being like, well, Lewis did it like that, but it's insufficient and the argument doesn't work here and this, that, and the other, which means he's still the person that contemporary scholars are pushing back against because he's so influential. Like, they have to, in many ways, address Lewis if they're going to address popular notions of theology, which means even his works that don't endure, and a lot of them do, like, people still read him, they're still moved, especially by his fiction. He's still the guy, he's still the bar to clear in subsequent generations. And that's a pretty good, you know, hold. It's 100 plus years of influence, you know, in a 500 year tradition. That's solid. That's solid. However, the thing that tips the scales for me is that there's nobody else like him today or since, in that for all of that theological output and all of that publishing and all of the influence and the writing that people have done about him and the study of him, Lewis was not theologically trained. Not only was he not ordained, he didn't go to seminary. He didn't get a PhD in theology. He's an English literature guy. He's a classics scholar who's actually a faithful, believer himself and writes from that place. And in that sense, there's nobody else that has ever done that or is doing that. Like, if you think about the people that are writing today in popular theology, most of them either have come from theological training, or if they're not theologically trained, they don't have the reach that Lewis had. He was like this wildly huge popular figure. I was thinking about it, maybe Bono is the corollary right now, in that like his current book tour is sort of a synthesis of all of his work and his faith as it's flown through U2 and into what he's doing now and his activism. And that's an interesting corollary, just because Bono was also not theologically trained.
Also Irish.
Also motivated by sectarianism. There's a lot of stuff about Lewis and his sort of approach in his ecumenism
also that shows Anglican.
Up in exactly. But like that,
not my person I chose. Damn, I could have chosen Bono.
But he's searching for that common ground, because he watches how religion can turn into violence. So that is my argument for C.S. Lewis. I would close with this collect for his feast day on November 22nd. O God of searing truth and surpassing beauty, we give you thanks for Clive Staples Lewis, whose sanctified imagination lights fires of faith in young and old alike, because he's the most influential. Surprise us also with your joy and draw us into that new and abundant life, which is ours in Christ Jesus, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever. Amen.
Amen.
Here's a question for you. Yes. Do you think part of his appeal in the evangelical world might be because he has a dramatic adult conversion experience story?
100%.
That's interesting.
And I think he's writing at a time in the sort of grand evolution of human consciousness, where logic is really important. That's part of human development, where you're this makes sense and is reasonable, you know? Yeah. And I think he was communicating at a popular level around that was sort of the center of gravity of culture at that time. The center of gravity of culture has kind of moved now. And we're in a different phase of human consciousness, if you look at how psychological development works, but you have to go through that phase to get to the next phases. They're cumulative. And so Lewis, I think, remains endearing because he's that bridge of this can make sense and can be a stepping stone into holding paradox together, which Lewis was good at too.
Yeah.
I think evangelicalism is pretty stuck in the logical place, you know, like that's its spot, which is why they grabbed Lewis. Like he was orthodox and he, you know, they, I think that's why he continues to resonate in that faith system.
Yeah. I have to say, very good. I also have to say, I'm having a little bit of a cognitive dissonance here because I can see the screen of Jason's computer and Dixon is on a video.
I'm multitasking
screen. And so you're talking here and you're also in the chancel there talking and gesticulating. And it's a little trippy. I'm not going to lie.
Because all I do is run my mouth.
Yeah, that's fair.
Or like George Costanza, you're ubiquitous.
Okay. Can we share though?
Yes. Now,
because I did not choose Thomas Cranmer.
I did not choose William Wilberforce.
Interesting. I was like, of course he's talking about Cranmer.
When he said revolutionary, I was like, it's got to be Wilberforce.
That's solid. That's solid. Well, I'm glad I didn't choose Wilberforce because then I would have really crushed you.
Yeah.
But I'm going to crush you in a different way now, argument style. But let me say, there's actually a couple of parallels between our people in unexpected ways.
I love this.
There's a biographical connection and a theological literary style connection. Which we'll get to. But to prove my victory, we're going to play a little word association game.
Oh my gosh.
Thinking about people across the world, okay. You're going to fill in the blank.
Let's do it.
Fill in the blank.
Okay.
Nobel Prize laureate and Archbishop
Desmond Tutu.
Desmond Tutu.
I almost picked Tutu.
Yeah. Thinking about simply from the place of name recognition, it's hard to think of someone with more cachet and recognition who also is recognized in the same breath with that tag Anglican. The Anglican Archbishop of Southern Africa.
Yeah.
You know, even years after he retired as the Archbishop, that was still his title. That is still how he was introduced the world over. And the thing that's fascinating about him in you know, revisiting his biography and reading some of his stuff, we often think of him as, you know, the guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work campaigning against apartheid in South Africa.
Yeah.
His political you know, chairing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the late 1990s, following the free election for the first time in the history of South Africa and all the stuff that came about as a result of that, traveling to hotspots worldwide, including Northern Ireland, Nicaragua, various places, other places around the world, a political guy, right? Who uses his platform as a representative of nonviolent resistance to enact change in political systems. And all of that work comes from a very solid theological faith-based background. For Desmond Tutu, he couldn't separate those two things. So you intentionally chose someone who was not political. I couldn't help but choose someone who actually did have a very significant political presence. But what was fascinating was to realize this guy had multiple degrees, not only in theology, but in biblical studies, church history, biblical language. I mean, you name it. This guy was a powerhouse scholar.
Yeah.
Who would himself claim the reason he was able to do the work he did and why he felt so passionately about the work he did was because he was so firmly grounded in the fundamentals and tenets of Christianity as he understood it. He was actually not born into Anglicanism. He came to Anglicanism as a young man, as a teenager, but he was born into a South African Methodist family. So he was born into Christianity, but of the Methodist flavor. His father actually taught, was a headmaster of a Methodist school And at the time when what was known as the Bantu education system was just forming in South Africa. So the first stirrings of official government-sanctioned apartheid in the early early middle 20th century. Tutu was born in 1931, just when these sort of things were becoming more and more established and entrenched. So he himself attended what were known as Bantu schools. His family spent a brief amount of time in the African Methodist Episcopal Church before finally discovering the Anglican Church of South Africa. So as a young man, early teens, Tutu then became an Anglican as a young man. He was a sickly child, so he had a number of stays in hospital. At a certain point, well, as a child, before his significant hospital sojourn as a young teenager, once his family started attending the Anglican Church, as a good child in an Anglican church, he started working as a server and an acolyte. And he then went to, he was able to attend a school. His parents moved around a lot, both parents working and looking for places and jobs. So he was born in, I'm trying not to reference my notes, but the Gauteng, you know, sort of the Eastern Cape. So southeastern part of South Africa. They moved to Johannesburg and lived in one of the townships in Johannesburg. And there was a parish church there, Church of Christ the King in Sophiatown. And during those days in the 1940s and early 1950s, the vicar priest of Church of Christ the King in Sophiatown was an English priest by the name of Trevor Huddleston. Yes, Dixon's mouthing the words over there on the other side of the room.
I love this story. It's so good.
Trevor Huddleston was, I almost thought about choosing him.
Oh, interesting.
But then I was like, no, that's unfair to Bishop Tutu. Trevor Huddleston was a cool guy, really, really fascinating person who deserves a podcast in his own right for different reasons. But Trevor Huddleston was an English priest who went on later to become a bishop himself. In the South Pacific. He also served as a parish priest in a few slum churches in Eastern London. And Trevor Huddleston was an English priest who was dedicated to the cause of eradicating apartheid. There's a statue of him now in Cape Town with a quote from Nelson Mandela that says, "No other English person did more for the cause of South Africa than Trevor Huddleston."
Wow.
But this is not a podcast about Trevor Huddleston, so I'll bring it back. I have a dear friend of mine who is a priest in the Church of England, was ordained by Trevor Huddleston. So it's interesting to hear him tell stories.
That's about interesting.
Knowing him personally towards the end of his life. But Trevor Huddleston, Desmond Tutu as a young man began to attend that parish and also served as an acolyte and server at Christ the King and came under the influence of Trevor Huddleston, who it wasn't a direct line to Tutu becoming ordained, but he would later say, and other people, biographers have said, no other individual person had more influence on Tutu's ultimate life and the shape of his life and the things he did than Huddleston. When he was about 16, Desmond Tutu contracted tuberculosis and spent many months, almost a year. He had to take time out of school to be in a hospital.
Oh, wow.
Because of his tuberculosis. Once a week, Huddleston came and visited him in the hospital. Every week, he was there and sat with him for an hour, and they just talked and prayed. So Tutu kind of retained that influence. He then went to, college, went to the university and, as an undergraduate, his degrees were in English. And then he went on, to work as a teacher. He was a school teacher in a few schools for years. But that little voice in his head finally said, ordination is his path, his vocation is his calling. And so he attended theological school in South Africa. He actually was able to attend at the time the National Theological College, which was the only racially integrated higher education school in South Africa at that time. And from there, he was able to travel to England, and he studied theology in London. By this point, he was married and had infant children. A few years later, went back to England for a second period of study after he was ordained. And he will talk about those two times spent years in London. His quote is, "Racism, of course, exists in England, but miraculously, Leah, his wife, and I never directly experienced it ourselves." He also would claim that his period of time spent in England is what allowed him to find his voice as a person who was willing to take risks and stand up and argue and push back. And previous to that time, as a young man, he was the person who would all, if a white person walked into the room, he would defer to them. If a white authority figure said something, he would defer. But after spending time in England, surrounded by white English people, studying with them, he realized that was unnecessary, and he didn't have to do that. He had his own voice, and it was just as valid and just as powerful. He's ordained. He returns. He serves a parish in a black township in South Africa as the parish priest.
Okay.
He then is approved for further study. He goes back to England as a priest, and he serves as a curate, assistant priest, at a couple of parishes. So he's now working at a parish as a priest with white congregants. That's the first time he's done that. And then he returns again to South Africa and is hired as an assistant priest at the cathedral.
What year is this?
This is the early 1960s.
Okay.
Early 1960s. He's now back in South Africa. He works at the cathedral, the dean of the cathedral in Johannesburg, which is the second largest church in the Anglican Church in Southern Africa. The largest is the cathedral in Cape Town. The dean of the cathedral in Johannesburg is elected bishop of Johannesburg, and Tutu becomes the dean of the cathedral. He becomes the first black dean of the cathedral in Johannesburg. So he's now ministering to a mixed race congregation. A few years later, at this point, he's already writing books. He's already making a name for himself as a theological thinker, and as a theological thinker who is using his theological training to speak out against the apartheid system in South Africa.
Yeah.
From a posture of, if you really pay attention to what Christianity is teaching, this system makes no sense. It's nonsensical. Why does it exist? The Afrikaner Dutch government that is in control they're Calvinist Congregationalists. They are Christians too. And so he's able to speak to these government leaders to say, look, do we not believe in the same God? Do we not read the same Bible? Do we not claim the same faith in Jesus Christ? Are we not, in fact, brothers in the faith? Why then can you perpetuate a system that so obviously doesn't stand up to scrutiny in our faith? And that was just the way he spoke. It was his writing is so, and his speaking both are so direct and so to the point that it's easy to not think about the fact that it comes from a place of very profound, deep theological thinking and prayer. So we'll come back to that again. He is elected to be a bishop, the bishop of Lesotho, which is one of these tiny little nations that's completely surrounded by South Africa. Mm-hmm. It's a kingdom, the kingdom of Lesotho. It's a very rural place. The people at the cathedral in Johannesburg were actually a little bit upset. They said, oh, you just used your deanship for a couple of years as a stepping stone to then be elected bishop of Lesotho. Well, in fact, he was not the bishop of Lesotho for very long, because then he was then appointed to be the president chair of the the African Council of Churches, which took him back into South Africa again. That was when he really started doing his worldwide tours as the representative chair president of the Council of Churches. He traveled across the continent of Africa and beyond. And this is now we're getting into the 1970s. So now we're in the 1970s. He's writing books, collections of his sermons, other theological writings. He goes on these speaking tours. He spends a lot of time in England again. He and actually what he has to do is he because he's beginning to cause these waves, he has his passport revoked at least twice, maybe three times, if I'm remembering correctly. But he writes these letters to the government to say, I need my passport back. And he gets it back. He gets I just want to read a little excerpt, if I may, of one of these letters that he writes talking about how he needs his passport. He's sending a letter to John Vorster, who is the Prime Minister of South Africa before Botha in the 1970s. And he writes this long letter. He's so eloquent. And it's this disarming eloquence that he has. It's like C.S. Lewis. This is the point I was going to make. It's so logical.
Yeah.
It's just this clear, logical, think this through and you'll see. I mean, what he's not saying is you'll see that I'm right.
Yeah.
But how can you argue against this just clear, logical, coming from this place of profound prayer and theological thinking? It appears that then, as if Christianity is interpreted by those advocates, the advocates of the structures of apartheid, as an anemic reconciliation and aimed at their domestication, it is forgotten that reconciliation is no easy option, nor does it rule out confrontation. After all, it did cost God the death of his son to effect reconciliation. The cross of Jesus was to expose the sinfulness of sin when he took on the powers of evil and routed them comprehensively. No, just as there can be no cheap grace, so there can be no cheap reconciliation, because we cannot cry peace, peace, when there is no peace. We must, therefore, examine the biblical evidence to see what the scriptures say about liberation. Do they say God is concerned only about individual salvation and has no interest in the redemption of the socio-political and economic matrix in which individuals live? Does it say the world is religiously and ethically neutral and of no consequence to salvation and the final consummation of all things, that what happens in the marketplace, in the courtroom, or in parliament is of no particular religious significance, and that all that matters to God is what is confined to the sacred sphere of the ecclesiastical? Does it say God is in fact not really interested too much in what happens from Monday to Friday, but only in what happens on Sunday? And that he does not much care about the plight of the hungry, the dispossessed, the voiceless, powerless ones? That he does not take sides? When two persons are engaged in a conflict and one of them is considerably stronger than the other, to be neutral is not just and fair and impartisan, because to be neutral is, in fact, to side with the powerful. I do not think that the Prime Minister was expecting this when he received a letter asking for Tutu's passport back. But that really encapsulates so much of Bishop Tutu's message.
Yeah.
Is, and he would claim to his dying day, he would say, I'm not a politician. I'm not political. I'm speaking from a place of Christian faith.
Yeah.
He discovered these different strains of theological thought. The school of thought known as African theology, which is different from Black theology, which we're more familiar with in this country.
That's right.
He took those two different strains and put them together. Hmm. He was exposed to liberation theology during his time in London, and that became a big informing voice for him as well, that God has a preferential option for the poor.
Hmm.
That's how he reads scripture. And wove all these things together to create that particular voice that he had to talk about God's dream, reconciliation. He introduced all of us to the word Ubuntu, which is a cultural concept among various indigenous ethnic groups in Africa, particularly Southern Africa, that is all about identity is primarily found in community rather than the individual. And I am an individual because you are an individual and we have a relationship together. I find my identity through encountering other people's identities. That became the crux of how he read scripture and interpreted the gospel, and then was able to stand and say, these systems don't make sense. To go back to his biography, he was elected the first bishop of Johannesburg, the first black bishop of Johannesburg. So he became not only the first black dean of a cathedral in South Africa, he became the first black bishop of a diocese in South Africa, which also enlarged his platform to be able to speak out publicly. And then 2 years later, in 1986, he was elected the primate of the province of Southern Africa as the Archbishop of Cape Town. He became one of the few leaders of the anti-apartheid movement who, at that point, he had been imprisoned a few years earlier when he was a priest. But once he became Archbishop, he was never imprisoned again. He had, you know, assassination plots going around against him, but a lot of those were directed towards other people because the folks behind the scenes, you know, in government orchestrating those things realized that he was so powerful a figure, and as a religious leader, they felt like they couldn't touch him. He became so well known and so powerful that he was able to openly critique these things. He was the one who was calling for governments around the world to institute boycotts against South Africa.
Enter Bono.
Exactly. Enter Bono. Into this, you know, we must, to have a South African saying to the world, boycott our country, tighten the screws against it so that these things can change.
And Bono name drops Tutu in the live version of Bullet the Blue Sky. Where he's talking about standing with Tutu for these sanctions against world leaders while they argue.
Well,
they fail to support a man like Bishop Tutu calling for economic sanctions. I've only listened to it a couple million times.
He also, and this informed everything. He was the bishop who introduced female clergy to the Anglican Church in South Africa. He would appoint gay priests to roles specifically. And then as Archbishop, and after he retired, he became an outspoken advocate for the full inclusion of gay and lesbian Christians, both as people who had full participation in the life of the church, should be married, should also be ordained, as married people. You know, he also was a tireless advocate for environmental creation care. All of these things stemming from that same place of, if we are created in the image of God, the imago Dei, that Latin phrase for the image of God, is one of his tent stakes for his theology. If we are created in the image of God, then who we are is no better than who anyone else is around us, and that we are all in God's image. He appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. How many other Anglican leaders are on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as and because of their status as Anglican church leaders? And
it's a pretty narrow window historically.
It's a very narrow window. And the thing that
if you're really going to lean on that,
he was also known for his wonderful sense of humor and his wit. And he would say that, well, listen, I have seen such pain in my life and witnessed such heartbreak and gross sin that that sense of humor not only is allows me to maintain a sense of humility, but also just to cope. There's so many little soundbite quotes, but the one I always remember that's so remarkable for Desmond Tutu is that he would never allow someone to refer to someone else as a monster, no matter what they have done. He would say, you cannot call a person a monster, because the minute you call them a monster, they're no longer a human being. Therefore, they're no longer worthy of respect or in the image of God or needing either love or reconciliation. He can now, he said, now you can say that something that people do is a monstrous act, but if we ever lose sight of the fact that these people are people, then our work is, it can't be accomplished. I always think about that as just
it's awesome.
Just a soundbite for encapsulating all of his perspective on the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking while you were talking, like, whereas Lewis is primarily known for his, and I think his influence comes from his literary work, his writings, Tutu, it's his public witness. It's like who he was in the world. 'Cause his influence, I mean, is once it blows up in the '80s and nineties, like he becomes kind of, I mean, he's like on stage with the Dalai Lama, which, by the way, they would like tickle each other when they saw one another. It's like this, they would giggle. Like there's this way that like you see the trajectory of the healing of pain is this like joy that transcends it. And the truth of God, like there, he's a remarkable dude.
Remarkable guy. And, you know, you hear about him, people describe him as this little guy, small in stature. I met him once. And I was not prepared for just how small in stature he really was. He was a tiny person.
Yeah.
I mean, part of that could have been from his childhood being sickly and tuberculosis and all that. But, and it's just remarkable that how such a physically small person could have such an enormous witness in the world.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep.
And, awesome. And he himself would make jokes about that. He says, yeah, doesn't God have a sense of humor?
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. It's great to have you back on the show.
Well, it's good. And I feel like, I mean, everyone, I think, can agree that C.S. Lewis is definitely more influential because they want to lift up the laity and not someone that's so learned and such an insider. But how are you going to turn down Tutu? I don't know.
It's a tough one.
It's on your conscience. It is.
Well, just if the Anglican Church can be remembered and thought of in the same breath as Desmond Tutu, I think we could do worse.
Yeah.
And if they also think about C.S. Lewis, maybe a minute later.
Well, listeners, the cases have been presented and now the power is in your hands. If you're listening on Spotify, there's a link to a poll in the episode description. Let us know who you think told the most compelling story. Voting for all episodes are going to remain open until the season one ending, which we will then announce the champions. We continue to release new episodes each week, so be sure and check often wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to everyone who's been subscribing. Please continue to like and subscribe if you want us to come back for a second season, and be sure to tell a friend about us. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.